Thanks for tuning in for the April 27th podcast. I'm Jose Merino, Editor-in-Chief of the Neurology family of journals. This week's feature interviews with Professor Maria Eriksdotter, and it focuses on the long-term effects of cholinesterase inhibitors on cognitive decline and mortality. For our What's Trending segment, you'll hear Dr. Martijn Weerberg discuss pharmacovigilance of patients treated with disease-modifying therapies for MS.
Hi, I'm Jeff Burns from the University of Kansas Alzheimer's Disease Research Center, and today I'm with Maria Eriksdotter from the Karolinska Institute in Stockholm, Sweden. And today we're discussing her study of the long-term effects of cholinesterase inhibitors on cognitive decline and mortality in patients with dementia. Welcome, Maria, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be with you today.
Great. Well, yeah, so you found evidence that cholinesterase inhibitors are associated with modest cognitive benefits that persist for over 5 years. And along with that, the mortality risk was somewhat lower in the group treated with cholinesterase inhibitors. So tell us about your main findings and briefly describe how you did this study.
I'd be happy to. So, as you said, the cholinesterase, we could show that the cholinesterase inhibitors are associated with cognitive benefits, and they are modest. They persist over a long time, for up to 5 years. And then the results also showed that treatment with cholinesterase inhibitors was associated with reduced mortality risk of 27% in patients with Alzheimer's disease who were treated with cholinesterase inhibitors. And the third thing we also showed was that galantamine was the only cholinesterase inhibitor which demonstrated a significant reduction in the risk of developing severe dementia, in addition to presenting the strongest effect on cognition. Also, if you know, wanted to know how we did this, the study is actually based on data from the Swedish National Quality Registry, Sveadem, the Swedish Dementia Registry, which is actually the world's largest database on dementia disorders. And in this database or in this registry, we follow a patient at the time of dementia diagnosis. Then we follow them annually. And in this study, we looked at data on 11,600 patients with Alzheimer's disease who were treated with cholinesterase inhibitors. And then we followed them for up to 5 years and compared them to data from a matched control group of 5,800 patients with Alzheimer's disease who did not receive treatment with cholinesterase inhibitors.
Great. Yeah, no, that's a very important data set. And so tell us a little bit about why you did this study. And in particular, there's a gap in long-term data, correct?
Yeah, I've been working, I'm a geriatrician actually, but I've been seeing these patients for many years, and the cholinesterase inhibitor trials, most of the trials are, you know, short-term trials for up to 6 months, where you have data for up to 6 months of cognitive benefits. And there are two trials with data for up to 1 year, which also show effect on cognition and also some functional outcomes. And there is also one study that on donepezil for up to 2 years, but that was a little bit underpowered study and the data from that was hard to interpret. So I thought that we need to sort of look at, as a clinician, I think it's important to know, you know, how do these cholinesterase inhibitors, how do they work for long term? Since the patients also with Alzheimer's disease, they live for a long time, and when you put them on the medication, they will be treated for a long time. So it's important to get data on long term effects of the cholinesterase inhibitors.
Yeah, I agree. And I think this does fill sort of an important gap in the literature. And it's potentially of very high importance given how widely used these drugs are in treating patients with dementia and Alzheimer's disease. And I'll say, as a dementia neurologist myself, I prescribe a lot of these cholinesterase inhibitors. But I can also say that a lot of physicians are very skeptical about this class of drugs. And many even question whether we should use them at all, given their modest benefits. So what's the prevailing attitude in Sweden?
Well, also in Sweden, there is some skepticism. Also, there is also, you know, a lot of cholinesterase inhibitors prescribed, but there is also, you also usually have to defend why you use the medications and so forth. And sometimes I get really upset about this because I have a trouble in understanding why people are so skeptical to these medications. Why should people suffering from a deadly disease, which Alzheimer's disease actually is, and they should not be given the medications, albeit the effects are modest, while we are waiting for cure. I think we should use, you know, even medications that are that give cognitive benefits. And especially also because we have also other studies shown that this, you know, the cholinesterase inhibitors also are associated with long-term positive effects on cognition and also on reduced, you know, risk for myocardial infarction, reduced risk for stroke. And there is also some data which says that if you use cholinesterase inhibitors, you can reduce the use of antipsychotics and anxiolytics in these patients.
Okay, so modest benefits from a number of angles, what you're arguing for. Let's just specifically to the study that you've done, and you know, can you talk a little bit about the size of the cognitive effect or the effect on mortality that you observed, and how this might, you know, inform this question of how aggressively we should use cholinesterase inhibitors?
Well, the effects are modest, but for over 5 years, we could see that these patients who were treated with cholinesterase inhibitors were always, you know, improving compared to the untreated group. So it's a long-term effect, which I think is very important to show here. That's one thing. The other thing is also the risk on mortality, and the effects on mortality is quite substantial. We could see a reduction in mortality of up to almost 30% in patients treated with cholinesterase inhibitors. We also had two groups, patients with MMSE more than 20, and which, you know, and looked at treatment or non-treatment in that group. And we also looked at treatment for patients with MMSE below 20. And in both these groups, we could show the benefit of cholinesterase inhibitors, which I also think is important.
Yeah, great. Now, an important caveat is this is a non-randomized study, and you compared, you know, the treated group to those who were not treated for whatever reason, real world reason, they weren't treated, you know, made decision made by the treating physician. And could it be that those untreated individuals decline more rapidly because of reasons for not treating them? Or could that potentially explain these results?
Yeah, it could, but we tried to look into that because we used propensity score matching. So those 11,500 patients who were treated, they were compared with the group who were untreated, and this group was untreated. They were exactly the same as the treated group, you know, age, sex, baseline MMSE, comorbidities, and medications. So the only thing that differed between the groups were the cholinesterase inhibitor treatment, and we still saw these effects.
Right. Okay. So you thought about that and you matched carefully.
Yes. But of course, I mean, this is an observational study. Of course, you cannot really infer causality, but I mean, I think it's important data they will show for long term here. And in my view, it's very difficult. How do you do a randomized trial in patients for 5 years, especially if one group should be, you know, not treated and the other one should be?
Right. Okay, great. And so, okay, with that in mind, let's just kind of sum things up. Do you think there's any clinical implications that you want to make from this study? Any messages for the practicing clinician?
Yes, I think that we should recommend cholinesterase inhibitor for patients with Alzheimer's disease. Of course, they need to tolerate the drugs, but we should also keep them on these drugs for a long time, at least 5 years, what we can show here. So I think that's a very, very, you know, strong recommendation. And in the study, we could also see that galantamine reduced the risk for severe dementia, which I also think is important if it is like so that these medications also can reduce the risk for severe dementia. But that needs to be investigated further, you know, to compare the different cholinesterase inhibitors more than, so that's the focus for next studies, I think. And one more thing, you know, we've had these drugs, these cholinesterase inhibitors, since the mid-90s. We still have no cure for Alzheimer's disease. The drugs show cognitive benefits, and they show also now then persisting cognitive benefits. They show reduced mortality and possibly reduced risk for severe dementia. So use them.
Great. All right. Thank you, Dr. Eric Stotter. This is a really interesting study, and thank you for discussing with us today. And please take a look at Dr. Eric Stotter's article in this week's issue of Neurology.
Thank you.
Hi, this is David Lapidus at the University of Virginia. Today, I'm joined by Martijn Vijberg. He's a resident in neurology at Amsterdam University Medical Center. He's here to talk to us about his paper, Pharmacovigilance During Treatment of Multiple Sclerosis, Early Recognition of CNS Complications, published in the February edition of Journal of Neurology, Neurosurgery, and Psychiatry. Martijn, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, David.
Of course. So really wonderful article where you all go through so many of the different infectious, non-infectious, vascular, and malignancy complications related to multiple sclerosis medications. I really recommend all of our listeners take a look at it. But in the meantime, I'd like to cover a couple of different aspects of the article. And I think there's a lot that our listeners can learn about, both with regards to new or emerging complications related to some of the medications that we use, as well as ways to watch for these complications and how to counsel our patients on them. So we've all known about progressive multifocal leukoencephalopathy and its association with natalizumab, but there's been a host of cases on patients who are taking fingolimod, and then maybe even a patient on ocrelizumab, which is obviously a very widely prescribed CD20 inhibitor. How are you counseling your patients regarding this risk? And maybe you can say a little bit more about the risk of PML on ocrelizumab.
Obviously, the incidence rate of PML in other treatments than natalizumab is clearly much lower than with natalizumab. But I do think it's important to mention this risk to the patients. But also put it into perspective, like contrasting the natalizumab treatment, for instance, when you're counseling them for second-line therapy. So with rituximab, it has been described that the incidence is around 1 per 20,000 patients. And with ocrelizumab, obviously right now, there has only been one case reported. So it appears to be even lower than that. But I think we should still, you know, await more long-term treatment experience with this. And with regards to the one patient which has been treated with ocrelizumab and did develop PML, I think it also really exemplifies that immunosenescence can play an important role in the development of PML. It's a phenomenon that we see also with other PML due to other treatments, and also even with other infectious complications than PML. We see that immunosenescence can really be a factor.
And could you say specifically with regards to fingolimod, what are the factors specifically that we've found that increase patients' risk of going on to develop PML?
Yeah, I think with fingolimod, it has not been developed a specific method for risk assessment like there has been or there is with natalizumab treatment. I think you should be much more careful when treating older patients with fingolimod regarding the risk for PML. And also, you should clearly frequently measure the lymphocyte counts, as we feel that lower lymphocyte counts can predispose a PML in these patients.
Certainly. And we know that when we monitor the lymphocyte counts in patients on fingolimod, their levels can be alarmingly low. And while we choose to just follow that most of the time, it certainly can lead to some of these more rare infectious complications. So making sure that we know our JC virus status going into any specific medication choice seems important. And not to pick on fingolimod, but one section of your paper talks about vascular complications of new MS medications, specifically RCVS and PRESS. Can you talk about fingolimod and those vascular complications?
Yeah, so one of our chapters is about RCVS and PRESS, which has been reported in the literature with fingolimod treatment and also in a few cases with natalizumab. But for instance, when you look at the Vigibase database on complications with medication, we see that PRESS and RCVS are reported a lot more frequent than is represented by the published literature. So we feel that this might even be more of a significant proportion of patients with this complication. And well, one hypothesis could be that these patients develop RCVS or PRESS with fingolimod due to the vasoactive properties of the drug, which I'm sure most people are aware of, that this drug does carry some cardiovascular relevant properties as well. So I think that could be one of the modes of action of the drug that leads to this complication.
Right. And we were talking about before we started recording that it'd be curious to follow the newer sphingosine receptor targeted MS medications to see if they have the same rate of development of PRESS and RCVS as fingolimod, given that they were specifically designed to have less of that cardio targeting. And let's just stay on the topic of vascular neurology for a moment. There was a scary time, I remember, in our clinic a few years ago when the data came out about dissections related to alemtuzumab right after the initial five-day treatment. What are you recommending to patients right now following their initial infusion regarding this sort of very scary complication?
Right. So yeah, that is a scary situation. And I have to say that at the moment in our center, we use alemtuzumab only as a real third line treatment approach, and only when we've exhausted other options or when there's a really highly active inflammation and or perhaps even contraindications for other treatments, then we do go to the alemtuzumab. But I have to say that we use it infrequently at the moment due to this scary situation. But if we do treat patients with this drug, I would definitely instruct them to be careful and vigilant, especially in the first few days or weeks after the infusion, as this is the moment when most of these complications occur. And I would encourage them to really present themselves to the emergency department or give us a call at least if they have obviously new neurological deficits, but also perhaps even when they do get a headache or a neck pain, which could be indicative of an artery dissection.
Right. And, you know, so many times we're thinking about the infectious complications and not necessarily the vascular complications that come from these medications or even just side effects initially, given you've had 5 days of an infusion with, you know, a 90 whatever percent rate of relative intolerance. And so patients already feel poorly, but certainly important for them to call us if there's actually new symptoms, because it'd be very unlikely that their MS would act up certainly at that time. And so lastly, I wanted to address the cryptococcal meningitis, which is a curious complication of several of our medications in MS. Is it possible for this infection perhaps to be like slower in onset, perhaps even indolent, such that we might have an opportunity to see it on MRI scans prior to infection? And if not, what exactly should we be watching for on MRI that's going to help us differentiate new MS activity from something like a new infection?
Regarding your first question, I'm not aware of any demonstration of latent cryptococcal infection of the CNS, but we do know obviously that it can be latent in the lungs. But it would be me being a pharmacovigilance enthusiast, I would love to be able to demonstrate that early on and prevent it to cause some serious effects. But if we do consider a patient to have cryptococcosis affecting the central nervous system, you should definitely look at signs of meningitis, obviously, which can be either lepto or pechy meningeal enhancement, which obviously you wouldn't see in new MS lesions. And also you can see with cryptococcus, you can see these very characteristic gelatinous pseudocysts, which are also called the soap bubble appearances. And this is something that you wouldn't see also with MS, obviously. In addition, these cryptococcomas have a predisposition for presenting themselves in the mesencephalon or the basal ganglia, which also, as you know, isn't a predisposing location for MS lesions.
That's some really great imaging pearls for us to keep in mind as we continue to monitor our patients with extraordinarily low lymphocyte counts who are stable from an MS perspective. Really interesting topics. Again, we've been speaking with Martin Weiberg about his paper, Pharmacovigilance During Treatment of Multiple Sclerosis, Early Recognition of CNS Complications, published in the February issue of the Journal of Neurology, Neurosurgery, and Psychiatry. Martin, thank you so much for joining us. This has been really interesting.
Thank you for having me, David. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Wonderful. Thanks again.
This is Jose Merino. Please check out this week's journal, which features an article investigating the incidence and prevalence of drug-resistant epilepsy, as well as a study examining the link between lateral pulsion and spatial neglect in patients with acute stroke. Please take a look at this and other articles in this week's issue. Thank you again for listening, and have a great week.
The views and opinions of the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the journal Neurology or the AAN. Disclosures of the participants are included in the show descriptions, reached by a link on the neurology.org website.